way or fear of you or anything.
I have a most interesting subject to discuss with you this morning. The singing ministry of our Lord and Savior. When we were children in Sabbath school.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Fundamentalist Podcast. My name is Elliot Morgan. I am here with my podcasting partner, Pete Rollins. I myself do stand-up comedy, and I do some internet things with a group called The Valley Folk. And Pete is a writer and a philosopher and a speaker who talks about how to live healthy lives and cope with doubt and uncertainty and all those fun things. And so this is a podcast where we talk about life and how to do, I guess, just that via some lighthearted fare. And then Pete will, basically the way it works is I'm going to tell you guys a little story. Pete is then going to give a reflection on it. Then we're going to chat about it. And then we're going to do a takeaway. That's the order of service. In the middle, we do communion, but that's not really true. Actually, we don't do that at all. We kind of were talking about that.
Well, communion, we have our communion wine.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah. But we don't take it.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Which is, we use trywink.com/fundamentalists if you would like to help support the podcast, or trywink.com/thefundamentalists. And it's a wine club where if you don't know anything about wine, you can take like palate quiz and it'll recommend cool bottles to you that are very like minimalist and cool looking. And there's like some beautiful, just like, I like it just primarily for the bottles, but the wine is also great. And you get $25 off if you want to order some wines to your door. But anyway, here's a thing that happened to me, Pete. Yesterday.
Tell me all about it.
Okay, so I'm really pumped about this thing, this like new trend in Los Angeles right now of apps for scooters. And so instead of like being like an Uber where you order a car, you open up this app and it shows you where these scooters are. And then you can go down and unlock the scooter and ride it around. And it's like a little motorized thing. You can get up to like 10 miles an hour in it.
And this, by the way, appeared from pretty much nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, it's taken over.
One day I was walking around, never seen a scooter hanging around in my life, and then one day it was just like scooters everywhere,
yeah,
like all just lying around. I could not figure out for the life of me
right. What
it was about.
Yeah, and it, apparently, I don't know exactly the story, but I think it was somewhere else, and they're just now incorporating it into the city. And this relates to the other thing I want to talk about that will probably come up, which is that science exchange thing that I did. And the guy talked about the scooter thing, and he was like, sometimes in the Los Angeles infrastructure, when the government can't fix things, the private sector will step in and do it. And he cited the scooters as the private sector kind of solving that problem. But anyway, that's a separate thing. I found that there was a scooter like right next door at the bus station.
Because it told you on your phone?
Yes.
Or is that a Nest?
No, it tells you on your phone. Okay. It shows a little lime and or a little slice of lime, and that's where the scooter is.
Oh, yeah. See, I was talking about the birds because they're called nests, the groups.
Scooters, birds, then yes, yes.
You were on a lime.
I was on a lime.
What's a group of limes? A
bunch. Yeah, a lime sack.
Yeah, a lime sack.
That's what it is. Yeah. So anyway, I went down there and like I found it and it was so fun. And I described it as like Pokemon Go, but somehow even lamer because the whole time I'm like, I hope nobody takes my scooter. And I'm on my way down there and I make my way and I find it. And it's just like nestled in the corner of this map of the area. But draped over the scooter are all of these dirty socks. And it was disgusting.
Yeah.
And below was like all this other dirty
laundry. I always leave my socks after and I was got like, off the scooter.
Yep. They even said they had.
Did you bring them back?
They actually had. It was weird. They had patreon.com/PeterRollins embroidered in the socks.
Nice. So. My mom does that on all my clothes, my underwear, socks. Yeah. That's very nice. It's very cute.
You know, she could just become a patron in that
way.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would really
be
help.
A little easier. Yeah. So anyway, I kicked off the socks because I was like, I had this dilemma where I was like, I'm going to touch where these socks have been, and is it worth it to ride the scooter around? And immediately I knew that it was.
Yeah.
And so I kicked it off and then started it and rode around, and my buddy showed up, and he was incredibly embarrassed to be around me. Because
that's usual.
It was the weirdest thing. He was like, he didn't want to be around, but he sees me and he starts walking away. And
it's funny that you think it's because of the scooter. I think that's very sweet.
It's, you know what it is? It's like the combination. We're gonna get more into this because this relates to the thing, but it's not the common. It's like me on a scooter.
Yeah.
Is just a level of like nerd dickishness that like it's really hard to like
just went over the top.
Yeah, it's too much. It's like the needle, it's the straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of unlikability for me. Okay. So I'm riding it around, I feel all the shame, and I realize that I feel this embarrassment because I'm around like people who are kind of like working very hard. There's like a it's a homeless area down there. And I felt like a jerk. Like I felt like how dare me like ride around on a scooter like some asshole when these people are struggling very much and they're, you know, whatever. And it wasn't this like it wasn't, I don't want to oversell it. Like I like, it was like a compassionate thing. Not that I don't have compassion, but it was like a thing where I felt that they were like, they would be judging, and rightfully so.
Because you were showing off how much money you have by being able to afford to ride on a scooter.
I know, for 15 cents a minute.
That's, yeah, that shows that you're in the big time.
I know, know, it does kind of fall apart when I'm like, it just seems, it's like, you know what it is? There's, okay, I actually have an answer to this.
Yes, I think I figured out. I have a thought as well, but you go for it first. Yeah,
I think it's the... It's not the amount that it costs to do it. Because for those listening, it's $1 to unlock it, and it's 15 cents a minute. It's the most fun thing in the world. Download it on the App Store. Have a great time.
You're not driving a Maserati, basically, around Hollywood where we live.
I'm not driving a Maserati. You're correct. But here's the thing. We've talked about this, and in terms of the value of things, which you, I know, have studied with, like, Zizek stuff. You, like, were saying something to me one time about, like, you know, the value of the Mac computer goes away, but there's the object still has inherent value in it because there's sacrifice put into it or something like that. Something, I don't know, whatever it is.
Whatever.
Yeah. But me hopping on a scooter and not even using it for transportation and riding it around, and there's like the app thing, the fact that people see me on my iPhone, they see me taking photos of it, they see me being, you know, doing selfies or whatever. It's not the monetary value of what I'm doing. It is the overall, I'm sending a message that I am live a different lifestyle in so many other ways.
Yes, absolutely. I think you're right. You know, if you can use something that is a means of transport and you're able to just jump on it, play with it, throw it down, it's the symbolism potentially.
Yeah, which is what I did. Like I wrote it for a few minutes and like left it like a block away.
Yeah. I mean, this is the same experience I get, and I think most of us get, unless you're a total psychopath, is when you're driving a car and there's someone who's homeless at the corner and it's a red light and you stop at the red light and the homeless person is there and they have a sign and there's suddenly a wave of shame and embarrassment that can come over you. And it's hard to pinpoint exactly why it is. I mean, you can give the person money, whatever, but there's something about the lifestyle that you're living that is so contrary to this other person's lifestyle, and it kind of confronts you with something that you'd rather not look at.
It reminds me of a conversation I was having actually after the scooter thing with my buddy, and we were talking about friends who they lose friendships because the person essentially becomes very successful or you know, whether it's entirely because of that is obviously a loaded assumption, but like, you know, they become successful and then because of that, they kind of lose their relationship. And it's primarily because there's like of money. Like it's almost like the same, you can almost see it happening in real time on different class levels.
Yeah.
Like if it's not like the homeless person looking at the guy in the Prius, it's, you know, the moderately successful person who all of a sudden can't be friends or is so contrary to the upper. Does that make sense?
I think it does. But so you're saying like when, say, a friend of mine becomes more successful, it can get in the way of the friendship.
Yes, because, there's a divide.
There's a divide.
As a result of just being more financially well off, essentially.
A lifestyle that seems more successful or something like that can get, you know, jealousies.
But you're kind of not saying that's the same thing.
I think it's linked. So we were talking, there's jealousy and there's envy and there's shame. And I think they're all slightly different. So shame is what I think you were feeling on the scooter and what I feel in the car. So I'd have to think about
it.
Maserati, yeah.
Okay. Anyway. So what were your thoughts? Cause I kind of, we got off on that tangent.
Yeah. Oh, I also, by the way, cause I heard you talking about the scooter stuff the other night, and I love, there was a line you used where, because they're littered everywhere. And what was the line that you had?
You're just driving around trash.
Which I think is,
or I think maybe you're just driving around litter. I think I did say
that. Yeah. Driving around litter. I thought that was, litter that is also transport.
Yeah. The thing was, the setup for that story was that I'd forgotten a joke on the way because I was so excited about the scooter, and which is its own kind of like, you know, that's the life that I'm living, where I am frustrated that I forgot a joke because I was on my way to find myself a little toy to play with. But anyway, I remember the joke, and the joke was a pickup line. Do you want to hear it?
Yeah.
Okay. It was, hey girl, are you Spotify? Because I plan on getting a lot out of the $10 a month I'm going to spend.
That's very good.
It's fun, right?
Yeah, that's good. That's
it's
good.
Just like
yeah,
a dumb.
Yeah, that's a dumb kind of funny joke.
Yeah. It's a nice time. Thanks for listening, everybody. This has been the Fundamentalist Podcast. I'm so sorry. I'm derailing. Okay. Back to
okay,
you.
Okay. So, when you told me the story, the first thing that came to mind was kind of in the Jewish tradition, you have the story of Adam and Eve. And in the story of Adam and Eve, there's a way of looking at it that it's partly about shame. So Adam and Eve, if you think about them as human beings at an evolutionary point where they become self-conscious. So there's a self-consciousness. And when they become self-conscious, they realize they're naked. And so they feel ashamed. So that's what it says in the text. They realize they're naked, they're ashamed, and they clothe themselves. And there is a notion, Dietrich Bonhoeffer talks about it, where shame is really an experience of being separated from each other, where we feel we're, that's what self-consciousness is, you're a self, so you're disconnected to the other people around you. And it's a sense of the nakedness of that. You're separate from, you're different from the other, and you experience that separation, and it's shameful. And so you cover over that with masks, so literally with clothes, but we have all of these symbolic designators. You're a teacher, a comedian, you're this, you're that. We have all these masks that we wear. And when these masks begin to be seen through, we experience shame. Now, I guess concretely what that means is whenever I drive up beside someone who's homeless and I feel this shame, or just walk past someone who's homeless, there is a sense in which I experience myself as like fundamentally separate from this person, and also that I'm no different from them, and that all these masks that I put on, they're kind of ridiculous. They're kind of ways that I protect myself from my vulnerability and from my humanity. And just briefly, the other becomes a type of prophet who exposes the truth of my frailty, my humanity, my vulnerability, my inhumanity. Mm-hmm. All of that is briefly experienced, and it's shameful. And so then what I do is I walk past that homeless person and I reestablish my masks. And we all have masks. There's nothing wrong with that. But our masks can sometimes separate us from each other. And whenever our masks become, you know, so solid, they kind of fuse onto your face and they become you. And it basically causes separation. So I guess this waffly way of talking about shame is the idea that, for example, those people who were watching you in the scooter, most of them aren't thinking about you. They're thinking about their living, their family. They're thinking about their health. They're thinking about what they're going to eat tonight, what they're going to watch on TV.
Yeah.
But in some respects, you projected onto them perhaps the vulnerability and the self-questioning you have.
Yeah.
So you projected onto them. And so in one sense, your masks briefly began to crack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and you totally felt ashamed.
I think it relates to as on the way down to find the scooter, as like, and it felt very like childlike. Like, I don't get excited about toys very often.
Yeah.
But for some reason, I just think this is so fun. And so like,
sex toys are an exception.
Sex toys are an exception. Yeah. You've seen my closet.
Yes, but, I have seen your bedroom. Oh my God.
swings everywhere. But yeah. I was like thinking, I was like, oh man, this is so cool. I was like, I live like, I'm so blessed. And like, this is such a night. And like, I had this very like real moment on the way down. I'm like, don't forget this. Like, this is a cool thing that's happening right now. I'm running downstairs to find a scooter to ride around and then have a drink with a friend. I was like, this is neat. I was like, I can't be too unhappy with anything in my life. And then that was like a very nice moment that I had completely alone and not around other people. And then when I'm actually doing it, I'm like, oh, it's like, it almost made me like I forgot my, like I got naive for a second. Yeah. I like went back to a place of like real naivety. So I don't know. It's very interesting.
Yeah. No, it's those moments. I think they're vital in our lives. Those little moments when we briefly see ourselves naked, like metaphorically, we see ourselves vulnerable, separated from others. We realize that we're playing games, that we have masks.
Yeah. I wonder if there's something where it's like, there's like a, by the way, Folks, if you're listening to this podcast and you're like, what is happening in this episode? Because that's partly how I kind of feel right now. Just so you know, we were talking about this for like actually more than we talk about most subjects prior to starting the podcast. And we got into the conversation and then we stopped it midway. And I think that's like, I don't know, it's like when you cut off the leg of the starfish and
oh, yeah.
eight more legs grow out. That's how starfish work. And
is that actually how they work?
No, no, that would be terrifying alien looking
yeah.
creatures.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
But I heard about this slug that absorbs algae and it incorporates the photosynthesizing elements of the algae into its genetic structure and never has to eat because it absorbs the power of the sun and it's the only animal that can do that.
This is a great analogy for what you were going to say, which uh-huh. is we can get thrown off course and say kind of things that seem disconnected and then there and somehow in the midst of telling people that you told me about a slug that is able to bring algae into its being through what is it through what do you call it
photosynthesis.
Very good. Yeah. Well, you know,
yeah,
what?
That's a great point.
And here's the
so
thing.
Sorry.
It's like when you study philosophy, people go like, where do you start? And the real answer is kind of you start anywhere because wherever you start, there's always someone else you feel you should have read. And then you go, I have to read them, I have to read them. But once that you jump in and eventually it starts to make sense like a 3D picture. And I feel that's the same thing with the fundamentalists. There is a time in the future, maybe it'll be 10 years time, when these will make sense, when the ramblings will suddenly come together yeah. in a harmonious yep. whole and people will cry. It'll be like a Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. This will bring peace.
I look forward to that
to the world.
I can't yeah. wait.
I look forward to it as yeah. well.
I can't wait to be able to really understand what I talked about
yes.
or was trying to say with any of it. It's all very exciting. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, all that to say, we were talking, we stopped the conversation midway and we were like, let's just hit record and see what happens. So it's a little bit more haphazard. But
but I think we're getting somewhere because when I think about it and when we're talking, I'm like, okay, I think there is something really to this idea that, you know, we get through life with masks, obviously, and the masks reflect something of who we are. But there are people and there are experiences of life that remind us that we're playing a game and that we're actually that we're hiding from our own vulnerabilities, our own absurdities. And
yeah, I think what might, and maybe this oversimplifies it or maybe it makes it sound worse or something, I don't know, but like I think what was really happening in that moment is I was like having a really good time by myself, like in public, and was not, I feel like sometimes I put upon this very like sad persona and then people think I'm sad and I oh, that's what it is. That's totally what it is.
I had someone say that to me today about you. I was doing a talk today in the Redlands in California and uh-huh. somebody said, you know, sometimes I think Elliot sounds like he's sad.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because I do. Like, it's not like I tend to, I don't know, it's so
I
weird.
Have heard the crying.
Yeah.
You know,
like,
yeah. Most nights I have to turn the music up
yep,
just
I know.
To cover it.
I know. And yeah. Which is weird that it's always the same Taylor Swift album, yeah, but it's fine.
I love that album.
But yeah, it's such a, I think what was happening in that moment was rather than walk around like I'm like not happy or like whatever, which I think is like a form of just protecting myself from like, you know, I don't know. I think whatever it is, it's a defense mechanism for sure. But yeah, I think I was just, I looked around and I felt like people could see me being this like joyful, happy person. I was like, oh, the jig's up. I'm actually,
well, that's exactly what Bonhoeffer actually means. This is great because, yeah, Bonhoeffer's thing is like,
yeah, we did it. We made a coherent podcast.
Yeah, we're getting there. Let's not say it. Let's not count our chickens.
But anyway, the slug was apparently evolved 10 million. No, okay.
Yeah, this is exactly it. Is that Bonhoeffer's thought is that the growth of self-consciousness is the growth of, you know, where I am separated from others. They can gaze at me. They can see me and I can see myself and my frailty. So in other words, you become aware of your death. You become aware of your finitude. You become aware of it. And so momentarily you were like not self-conscious. Momentarily you were lost in a type of childlike experience. But then you got shaken out of it by the gaze of the other.
Yeah.
And so there was a brief moment of shame.
Wow. That's fun. Yeah. That's what it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
One thing on that. Yeah. Because Jean-Paul Sartre, this is great. We're now bringing in other philosophers. We're pretending we make sense. He once said,
like a philosopher would.
Yeah. He said, hell is other people. And what he kind of meant by that is,
oh, no, I get it.
I've met
no,
people.
It's fine.
Yeah. No, I knew people.
It doesn't require any more explaining. Yes, we're good. It's back to the starfish. No, go ahead.
But he says, like, if you're sitting in a park or you're playing on a scooter and you're lost in your own world and you're looking at the world around you, you know, you're the center of your universe. But imagine then, you know, you're sitting on a park bench and suddenly someone turns and they look at you. The gaze of the other reminds you that you are not the center of their universe, that the gaze unsettles you. It's kind of like I am here as well. Someone else is there. Or if you're looking through a keyhole at two people doing something, and imagine they both look around and stare right at the keyhole, and suddenly you're decentered. You feel shame. And Sartre was saying that, in a sense, hell is other people, because other people's gaze reminds you of your own finitude, your own self-consciousness, your own death. All of that is caught up in that weird glance of the other. And I think when you were on the scooter, you were having an existential experience of the gaze of the other. That's a beautiful way to make that so grandiose, your ridiculous looking experience on the scooter.
Even saying that, like, with any form, knowing that there's truth behind it makes it somehow seem more like bullshit. Like, understanding what you're saying, like, and being like, oh no, I get it, actually in my mind makes it more embarrassing. Yeah. Thing to think about. But you're right, you're not wrong. That's exactly what was happening.
Actually, that's why I love the existentialists, by the way. They were brilliant at taking, like, really mundane experiences and saying something deep. So Sartre once looked at a couple. This man reached over to this woman, he touched her hand, and it was at a restaurant, and Jean-Paul Sartre was sitting there wondering, what would the woman do in response? And he said, you know, would she withdraw her hand, which would send a signal of, you know, I'm not into you? Would she squeeze his hand, saying, actually, I like you? Or would she keep her hand lying limp, not withdrawing it or, you know, squeezing it? And he saw this happen in real time, and this woman happened to just keep her hand there. And he was saying that this is a good example of all human beings, that we sometimes try not to make a decision. We try to avoid the what he called the condemnation to freedom. He said we are condemned to freedom, and we try to avoid this experience of responsibility. And it's wonderful because it's just a tiny experience. It happens every day in every restaurant across LA.
Yeah.
But he was able to make a really interesting observation about the essence of being human.
That's fun.
Yeah,
I like that a lot.
Yeah, so maybe that's what we should, that should be our attempt in this podcast. You doing something ridiculous and then us trying to make it seem like a grandiose heroic moment.
Yeah, there's been a few of those this week, I think. That we'll have when the time comes, we'll have some good fodder just based on
life. A good one that happened this week, which will someday be talked about.
It'll be great, man. Life is very fun.
Yeah.
Is there a difference between, in your mind, embarrassment and shame?
Yeah, in my head, the way I would say it is that, you know, there's a difference between the experience, for example, of I'm going to die someday, you know, this kind of, I thought I had a heart attack, but I didn't, and the realization I'm going to die. And also there's a difference between I feel guilty because I didn't help a friend, and condemnation, which is a sense of everything I do, I feel guilty about. And also you can do that with death, guilt, and I think shame as well. I think embarrassment is the weaker form. You know, you feel embarrassed about, you know, a particular little thing you did
wrong.
Trip
on the sidewalk.
Trip on the sidewalk, whatever. And shame, I would say, is a more existential category of maybe you feel embarrassed and you feel exposed pretty much ontologically, what it would be called, but all the time in the heart of your being. So I think shame is kind of like the underpinning of embarrassment.
When you were talking about the self-conscious, like being self-conscious is this sort of like understanding of all of these things, your death and your finitude and like people around you and all that, it sounds exactly like consciousness, like both in like, is it like, and I know we don't get too into that stuff here, but like it's an interesting thing that it's like self-conscious and consciousness. Like I think people in my personal therapy, that word gets used a lot, of like striving for consciousness in some way. And so it seems like that would be the same thing. You strive for self-consciousness and to like understand.
Yeah, I mean, I always think of like consciousness I don't think presupposes self-consciousness. So I think like certain animals have consciousness, but that they don't necessarily have a sense of self, an ego, a sense of subjectivity. Whereas for me, self-consciousness is a consciousness that is that can loop back,
yeah,
so that you can kind of think of yourself as a subject. So self-consciousness obviously arises out of consciousness. But so everyone who's self-conscious is conscious, but not everyone who's conscious is self-conscious.
I think we're thinking conscious like in a different terms. Ooh, I'm meaning consciousness in terms of like new agey sort of consciousness.
Oh yeah, I don't know what that is. What is that?
It's basically literally would be described as like you become aware, you become like, you know,
kind of like a hyper awareness of your environment.
No, not hyper awareness, just sort of like living in the conscious way, which would be, you know, fully integrated. Every part of you is like, you know, you're aware of your dark sides, your good sides, you're aware of your unconscious desires that you sort of like feed, and then you're aware of what, you know, how to maneuver through life better.
Yeah,
I guess,
you know, there's an existential version of that in that some of existentialists talk about a free decision isn't a decision that has no causality, but a free decision is a decision that kind of like comes from how could you say it? The center of your being.
Yeah.
That's what Sartre meant really by the condemned to freedom. It's where you take responsibility for what you do. And it doesn't sound a million miles away from what the New Age are talking about.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, a little bit different, but maybe there's...
Can be intertwined, I think.
Yeah, maybe a connection.
In my mind. But yeah, just because it's all the same kind of goal. But I think my guess is that one is goal oriented and more so. Like I think the New Age is like, oh, you can reach a certain. It probably differs from traditional psychoanalysis in that it's like implies that there's like this Zen sort of guru level that you can get to if you like constantly aspire. And then, you know, I don't think Freud would be in that boat.
Psychoanalysis. And the fact that I was going to suggest this for the theme, but I didn't. Is what paradox, which means like in psychoanalysis there's kind of an essential paradoxical nature to consciousness. So in other words, you can't ever integrate and be whole because you can never, basically a problem can be solved but a paradox can't.
Yeah,
a paradox can be manipulated and worked with but can never be solved. And so sometimes whenever I hear people who are into the New Age talk, it's like there is no fundamental paradox at the core of subjectivity. Whereas in psychoanalysis, there is a fundamental paradox.
Would that be like Jung? Jung kind of deviated from...
Yes, that's where Jung deviated from psychoanalysis proper, really, when he went in that more integrated direction.
Yeah, the more fun one.
The more fun one, yeah. I mean,
the one where you get to be happy.
Yeah. ironically, the one where you get to be happy, but it never works and you just get to be sad.
Yeah.
Whereas I think the Freudian one is like, we're all sad, but actually when you embrace that, you get happy.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Yeah. That's the most succinct argument for Freud against Jung that I've ever heard.
Yeah. And if anyone who's into Freud or Jung heard that, they'll probably be writing emails about how terrible that one-liner was, but it was a one-liner.
In this completely haphazard podcast on shame and slugs or something like that.
Shame and slugs. Oh, there you go. There's a title.
Shame, slugs, and scooters.
Yeah.
Just go for the
alliteration. So the algae literally through photosynthesis, like... integrates into the slug.
Yes, and only animal that can actually do that. So, you know, the rest of us get our stuff from, you know,
our from food. Eating.
Yeah, from eating.
But they don't. Do they have a mouth?
I think they do. I think it's like an option for them, or at least if they start with one. But then they don't need to eat anything. They can just literally. It's like a tree growing. Like a tree can grow from sun.
So what do they use their mouth
but
for?
We don't grow from the sun. We don't say what.
What do they use their mouth for?
I need to look into it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I need to, but he was like showing me this website and stuff. This relates also to what we're talking about because I went to this thing called the Science and Entertainment Exchange, and it was this event called One Night to Save the World. And it was my job to kind of interview these guys and like take some, you know, social media stuff for them. But I absolutely loved it. Like I freaked out. Like I felt, you know, you want to talk about feeling like a sense of shame. There was a sense of shame in the sense that like I was definitely so enamored happy and like, and it was like riding a scooter except I was having a conversation with like the guy who he's the city planner for Los Angeles.
It was like riding a scooter except I was talking to world-class scientists. In every other way it was just like riding a scooter.
It really was.
That's brilliant. Yes. I like
I can't I'm going to use that for everything. Similar,
like, yeah. whatever I do in life, like, this is just like riding a scooter, except
basically, literally, the reason I rode the scooter yesterday was because the night before I had this amazing experience with scientists and immigration experts and city officials, and I thought, how can I attain that level of joy and that level of connectedness? And I thought, well, I should go just ride this scooter, and so I did.
I mean, I did literally get a text from you saying, you want to go and ride a scooter and be laughed at by Mike? I think it's something similar
to
that.
Yeah. I knew that the embarrassment was coming. But anyway, I was with these people, and it was a city planner. It was an expert on immigration, the guy who does the marketing for this thing called Impossible Foods, which is delicious if you ever get
Oh, I've heard about that.
Yeah, and then there was a screenwriter. The screenwriter of Toy Story 4 and Thor Ragnarok was there. And so, and then there was a biologist. And our job was to come up with a way to solve the world problem of overpopulation.
I love that in the midst of that, there's a biologist, there's a city planner, and there's the writer of Toy Story 4.
Well, because that's what they did.
Because that's the first person I would imagine. Like we need world-class biologists, city planners, scientists, and who's the writer? Not of Toy Story 1 or 2 or 3. We need... Who's the writer?
The one that's
Toy
upcoming.
For?
The current writer.
Oh yeah.
She goes to her. Okay.
I'm sure she's brilliant.
This is No. This relates exactly to what you do and what your entire body of work suggests, which is that storytelling is the way you. So the premise was that all these people, the screenwriter took the solutions that they gave to overpopulation and turned it into a movie pitch, because their belief is that through storytelling you can actually change people's minds, which is exactly what it's like, the kind of crap you would have at Wake.
Yeah, that's why I've made a movie, you know, so like, it's a way to manipulate hearts and minds to become ruler of the world.
Yeah, exactly. And you're doing such a good job so far. But it is kind of up your, like, that
that's
would be
very
like
good.
A,
that's very good. Like, I have heard, I don't know if this is true, but I've heard, like, you know, for example, people who run prisons will talk to movie writers, because movie writers can think of very creative ways in which people might escape from a prison.
Whoa,
and
fun.
Then learn how to, you know, so because the creative thinking allows them to, which I think is pretty bad, because I think, you know, certain people should be able to escape from prison and certain people shouldn't. You know, if you're innocent, you should be allowed to escape. But then I don't know how you would implement that rule.
Well, you just ask them.
Yes. Oh, that's pretty good. Yeah,
that's just ask good. The prisoners if they're innocent or guilty. Yeah. And if they're innocent, they can leave.
Oh, there is that. There's not in. There's a great example of that in Monty Python's The Life of Brian, where I think they're going to crucifixion, and you have to say to the person, innocent or guilty, and they all go guilty, guilty, and then I think Brian's like, no, I'm innocent. And the guy, I'm really sorry, and then he goes, no, I'm only joking. I'm guilty. It wasn't Brian, it was somebody else. But anyway,
that's really funny. Yeah,
that's a good show.
Anyway, how long have we been doing this? Let's see what we're at.
I was also wondering whether, you know, sometimes we can go long, although I know that face that you've just made is, we've been talking for 3 minutes and 42 seconds. Should we juggle for
wrong.
A little bit?
Yeah.
You know, whereas the last Fundamentalist, I feel we could have gone on for 2.5 hours.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, the point I was going to say, and this is the final point, we can wrap it up. It can be a shorter
episode.
Well, we
don't have to wrap it up, because I feel like shame's got a lot.
Okay,
there's
great.
A lot in that, you know?
Well, there was a version of the shame I felt, I think, there with that group of people, but there was also a comfort level there, because I was around scientists and it was like igniting some part of my brain that like I haven't felt since college, and I forgot.
Your intellectual side isn't ignited by your experience of Los Angeles?
You know,
is that what you're saying?
It's really not. It's ignited by this conversation, but it was also interesting to hear the conversations they were having about city planning and all this stuff, and like, a lot of the problems they said were a crisis of capitalism, but at no point did the psychology of it like ever come into play, or like the philosophy behind it. It was all scientific, but it all just was like, oh yeah, no, a lot of this is just because of capital. Like, a lot of these problems, it's, you know, the root problem that you would have to get rid of comes from the system that we're in.
Yeah, that's the philosophical side, is how does ideology affect town planning and all of that. By the way, can I share my experience of reading down at the pool?
Oh,
as
yes.
The LA. I don't know if you remember this, but I was reading a book on psychoanalysis, and a couple of people came up to me and were like, what are you reading? And I was like, well, so it was a book actually on psychoanalysis and religious theory. And I was like, well, you know, it's about psychoanalysis. And they were lovely. They were really lovely people.
But what about religious theory? Oh, it is about religion. Oh, what are the odds?
Yeah. What's that?
If they were like, if you were like, oh, it's about, because it was on psychoanalysis and religious theory, it'd be funny if you said psychoanalysis and they were like, but what about religious theory?
Yes.
Like, oh, my God.
Do you not think that you could look at those together? Well, yeah, well, so happens. Well, no, that definitely wasn't the way the conversation went. I'll just tell you that right now.
Spoiler.
They looked at me blankly and I knew that I needed to kind of like widen the definition. So I was like, well, you know, it's about, you know, what is a subject, how we act and interact in the world. So continuing to be blank. And so I was like, okay, well, it's about predicting, you know, how we live and what we do in the world. And then the beautiful moment of realization, and they were like, oh yeah, we get what you mean. Brilliant. It's like horoscopes. And then they were like,
yeah.
I am Sagittarius or whatever. And
they said they're, oh, yeah.
Yeah. And what star sign are you? So I was like, okay, this is an interesting experience.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you feel a sense of shame in that there was you saw the stark contrast between you and them, but not on a
you know,
economic level, but on an intellectual level?
Well, the funny thing is, I did feel embarrassed. And again, if you take this idea of Bonhoeffer's, what is the embarrassment? It's not like, it's an embarrassment of separation. It's embarrassment of like, we are separate. Now, by the way, I will say, like, they were very cool people, very talented. I'm guessing they are quite successful in either music or the entertainment industry. So incredibly intelligent and talented in other ways. But obviously they've got, you know, like, just as I've got no interest in that, they have no interest in what I'm doing. But what was interesting is, yeah, I did feel embarrassed. And in relation to what we're talking about here, it was a sense of the separation between us. And it was also like the mask of my like reading and all of the symbolic things that define who I am kind of crumbling, briefly crumbling. And I felt embarrassed and I felt shame. Like, I felt naked in some respects. And that, again, for me, it's so vital. It's like why some people say grace before a meal. Obviously, it can be seen as religious, but sometimes I think it's a moment where you just pause and you realize your separation from other people in the world, that other people don't have what you have, and there's a separation and a lack. And the point of grace isn't to make you not enjoy your meal. It's just a moment that gets you to go, we're not all doing good. We're not all there yet, and we need moments that remind us of that.
Mm-hmm.
And those moments happen, and sometimes I try to protect myself from them. Like, that's why I say, like, I feel embarrassed if I walk past someone who's homeless. I would, like, you know, I would want to cross the street, because in a sense I don't want to be reminded of that. But some people do grace because they understand that we need to be reminded of
that's beautiful,
even though it's embarrassing.
And kind of, a you know, brings you down if you're having at a party to, like, take a moment. It's beautiful, and I love it at Thanksgiving and Christmas, when it's like, all right, we're gonna take a moment.
And that's the thing, like, I don't do it or anything, I really respect it, in the sense of, like, you're in a big meal and you're sitting around, and then someone says, in the midst of all the talking, in the midst of all the laughing, someone says, we'll say, take a moment and say grace, and then it stops.
Yeah.
And for this moment, maybe there's thankfulness. Sometimes people just do it in silence, but there's this little moment, or someone says, you know, there are other people who aren't at this table, there are people who don't have what we have at this table, and we just take a moment to remember that.
Yeah, just do that little gratitude thing. I love that stuff, man. I think I am a firm believer, as much as I don't like being like, you know, one of the most important things in life is to be, you know, like that, like heavy-handed kind of thing. But I do think if you can do anything that gives some kind of gratitude in your, like, reminds you a little bit that there's, so that you can be thankful and aware,
here's a pushback on that is, I'm more skeptical of the gratitude bit. Weirdly, what I want to affirm is the shame. I actually think that...
Shocker.
That whenever you do grace...
Oh, Pete wants to bring it down.
Yeah, I want to bring it down. That actually there is an incredibly important social function to feeling... I mean, gratitude's connected to it, but actually shame. Shame and embarrassment. But
not, I would agree in that gratitude in going down to the scooter...
Mm-hmm.
Put me in a bubble of naivete a little bit, I think. Yeah. I got excited. I got amped up. I was like, how cool is this? I'm using language. Like, I'm so in my head, like, oh, I'm so thankful for this. Like, don't, you know, be aware of this.
You got free socks out of it?
I got free socks.
That's funny. That's very funny. And
and then I think that sort of like, and then it's, you know, I'm in this, I'm surrounded by people who are, you know, scootering, and I'm doing a nerdy thing, and I tend to be a you know, I look a certain way. So if you add that to, I still think if you add me, I look, my buddy described me as like a human Gumby, like a human version of Gumby. Do you know who Gumby is?
No, I don't.
He's Gumby is a claymation character who's basically just a blue stick, and but he's like a rubber blue stick, and with like a little red nose or whatever. And so Mike likes to say I look like Gumby, like if Gumby, and then I also don't have the best definition between my chin and my neck, and he makes fun of that because friends.
Bring you down.
Friends stick up.
That's
yeah.
a very Northern Irish thing, by the way. Like, you know someone loves you if they ruthlessly try to destroy you.
Yeah.
And comedians do it here. Like, it's not as big a thing in some cultures in the US. Some cultures, I think it is, like New Yorkers. But among comedians, I love it. I was out last night with your friends, and I love the self-deprecation and also the kind of the attack, the loving attack on each other. It's beautiful.
It's really nice, but yeah, I look like a Gumby version. That's kind of like when Mike saw me after vacation. I like shaved off my like version of a beard, and he was like, "Oh, you shaved off your third eyebrow. Way to go!" I was like, okay, good joke, Mike. Mean joke. Funny stuff. But anyway,
that's why you were crying that night.
Right.
It's always nice to have a reason, know why you're upset when you come home.
Normally, I text and I tell you in the mornings. That last night it was because. Oh,
yeah.
But anyway, so I feel a certain sense of shame just because I feel like I just draw attention. I don't like drawing attention to myself.
Yeah.
Maybe that's all it is.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing, right? And because I feel like we're hitting on something, but it's a complicated issue and one that, you know, we can't really get to the bottom of here necessarily. But it is, what is the role of shame? What is the role of embarrassment? Is it always negative? Is there some positivity to it? Is it, but you also, without getting into the kind of mentality of like, you know, you should feel guilty for scootering. To what extent should you feel guilty for scootering? I don't think you should. You know, you went out, you played.
Look, I'm young, I'm hip, I'm going to scooter. Okay. Like, I'm a young single guy in Los Angeles. I'm going to be scootering.
Yeah, scootering is like, you know, you're cool.
It's baked into my DNA, bro.
You got money. You're
just,
you know,
whipping it around.
Whipping it around.
15 cents a minute.
Yeah. I mean, you can burn
for
through that.
For 5 minutes. Yeah. You know, it's like, I'm,
I mean, you
it,
scootered all the way from here to the Federal, which is at least 1.5 blocks.
I didn't.
You didn't?
I didn't even
Where
make
did you
it.
Go?
I made it from Chandler to the other Chandler.
Wow.
Which is just like, it's a split road. So it's
somebody
like a
stole
block.
My bike.
Yeah, man. I'm sorry about that.
That just literally came to mind because we're talking about scooters. Damn, somebody stole my bike.
That sucks. Yeah, you'd forgotten about it till right now. And I think you'd forgotten about your bike up until it got stolen.
Yeah,
it getting stolen was what made you like your bike.
I know, but that is true. Like, I didn't ever ride it. It just sat there. I bought it off a friend, my friend Rob, and it just sat lonely until somebody stole it, and I was like, oh, I missed that. But then of course now you've got scooters for 15 cents a pop.
Yeah,
so
dollar to unlock, and you scan a little QR code on it. It's so cool, man.
But by the way, do you know that what happens is, like, so somewhere like in Silicon Valley or whatever, people put a pile of money into this, but they haven't necessarily worked out the legal ramifications.
No.
What That's, they did yeah. just do it, and then they hope they solve a certain problem, and then when the legal ramifications come up, they just start working through it.
Yep.
I think that's fascinating. It's like they're doing this knowing that there's going to be a whole pile of stuff to work out, but they do it anyway. I mean, it's a fascinating
yep. and
thing.
They get probably pretty rich in the meantime because they're going to like get so much funding, and they're going to like...
And if it solves a legitimate problem, then it's like Uber kind of did that. Uber, you know...
They were talking about this at the Science Exchange thing. They were like, look at how quickly Uber in airports is what they're talking about.
Yeah,
and Uber in airports just collapsed like dominoes. The moment that the public was like, no, we want Ubers, and then like, boom, bye.
Yeah.
Or it was Uber fighting and Lyft fighting to get the rights to it. I don't know. But it was about like changing culture in order to change the, you know, consumption of things. But that's not exactly what we were talking about.
You know,
about.
By the way, and this is probably not off the point as well, but we're talking about, you know, ideas and just going ahead with ideas. I had some ideas about 20, 25 years ago that I went to the government in the UK to see if they could patent, if the ideas already existed, because I was going to invent some things. And the things that I thought I'd invented
were... I can't wait. Oh, no. This is what we're putting at the end of this podcast? Oh, I can't wait. I'm so excited.
I almost was a billionaire. You don't know how lucky you are.
Please tell me.
So I had the idea, like when mobile phones...
Are you for real right now?
I'm actually for real. Like whenever,
holy crap. Yeah. Really?
Well, I'm for real, but it completely didn't work out because it was ridiculous.
Well, clearly, yeah.
So, but when mobile phones first appeared, I was like, you know what? You could use mobile phones to do home security. That if you're out and someone breaks into your house, instead of phoning the police and all the expensive thing, it rings your mobile phone and cars. It will phone your car and you could start your car or whatever from your mobile phone. So when mobile phones got, I was like, I think you could use this technology to do it. So I went, the people I talked to were like, oh yeah, this is a good idea. We'll pay to get it, you know, to see if it's copyrighted. But of course it completely was, because big companies had already thought of it. But it took another 10 years before those ideas actually came out.
Oh.
But the ideas had already been kind of locked down.
Hold on. So the closest you ever came to being a billionaire was when you thought of something that had already been thought of?
Yes.
Yeah, the closest I've ever come to winning the lotto was when I saw the numbers that, like, the winning lotto... Like...
But nobody done it. That's the thing. I was, like, going to get some friends who were, like, IT people to actually make it. I could have been, like, TJ Miller on Silicon Valley.
Yeah, which you're making your way through. I'm happy
to see. Oh, it's very good. Because I've said this before, I'm not even sponsored by Peep Show. But Peep Show is
brilliant. Absolutely fantastic.
But I was worried that I would never find a comedy show that could like brings the joy that Peep Show has brought to me. And I think, I'm not going to say it yet, but I think Silicon Valley might bring me the same joy.
I can't wait for you to keep going through it. Yeah, it's so good. Good stuff. Anything else, any other takeaways?
Oh yeah, well let's do takeaways then.
Yeah,
we haven't done takeaways.
Let's try to take away something from this.
That top looks like a tile that you've made into a shirt.
And that was Pete's takeaway. No way. And this is, it's terry cloth.
What's it called?
Terry cloth.
It's like what you dry dishes with?
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah, and it's like it's from like the 70s or something.
It's a real deal?
Yeah, it's really old.
Oh, that's very cool because it does have that vintage kind of look.
I love it. I wish it was a little bigger or that I was a little bit more fit, but you know, I like it.
Yeah, very good.
Here's my takeaway. My takeaway is for sure I got embarrassed because I was like in my element and very happy. The gratitude shame thing is an interesting conversation that we should maybe have more of. But I like I think that there's like a nice, there's something for me to personally take away from the fact that when I tend to be very happy or very open and joyful, I feel a certain sense of vulnerability tied with that.
Yeah, very nice.
Well, any That's thoughts good. On that? Did what I said just make sense just there?
It did make sense.
Right.
So yeah. Well, and my takeaway is that shame is a basic category of being human. It is connected to being self-conscious, like to be self-conscious, to be conscious, like separated from everything else. Requires a certain experience of shame that we cover over with all sorts of masks. And there are moments when we are confronted with our own finitude and separation and vulnerability, and moments maybe when we pass a homeless person or when we do something silly or, you know, we have a disease that's embarrassing or whatever it is. And those moments are not necessarily bad. They can actually make us better people. You know, too much shame is going to devastate you and destroy you. But repressing it's going to also destroy you.
So you're going to be destroyed.
You're going to be destroyed, except if you can create spaces where you can allow it to do its work. And that's why, you know, something like grace at dinner, not that I do it, but as an example, religious people do.
Yeah, rituals, yeah.
Rituals that potentially allow that to happen, or that you welcome those moments instead of hiding from them or getting angry about them or like never talking about them. Those moments where you feel embarrassment and shame, you try to galvanize them to something valuable, to make them into something good. There you go.
That's wonderful. That is a beautiful takeaway. I would like to tell you a little bit about the sea slug.
Oh yeah, please.
It's an emerald sea slug. There is at least one animal that can steal the powers of the organisms it eats. The emerald sea slug, or Elysia Chlorotica and scientists to finally learn this bizarre creature's secrets. It turns out the sea slug is capable of stealing both the genes and cell organelles. That's things like mitochondria and the like. Mm-hmm. That are responsible for photosynthesis from the algae. This, or that'd be like chlorophyll, I think. This allows the slug to temporarily give up its life as an animal and instead live like a plant. It's an animal that lives like a plant.
Oh, my God.
And that's how I felt on that scooter. Everybody, thank you very much for
thank
listening
you.
To this very strange episode.
I think, but I don't.